item that I want to move to is we have some LC drafts that we'd like to introduce as committee bills. They should be in your packets, members. I believe there are a couple version of a successor plan and then a one-pager. Well, actually, it's a one-and-a-quarter pager now that I see the back of it, which is the, for lack of a better term, the Lipscomb expedite bill. Would expedite the Lipscomb decision of the Supreme Court. And then two draft successor plans, one a defined contribution, one a defined benefit. And just for the record, I expect these to be gut and stuff at some point after a lengthy negotiation. So if you see numbers in them or things in them that you do or you don't like, don't worry about it. All subject to change, sometimes with notice. So we expect that they will change. And so don't get wed to any particular concept, because they were just drafts to sort of set up a framework for us of questions we needed to ask. So at this time, I would entertain a motion to introduce these LCs as committee drafts.
So moved.
Representative Nolan moves that we introduce LC 1668, LC 1704, and LC 2116 as committee bills. Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, so ordered. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2004. And we have Mark Johnson with us today. Mark, if you'd come up. We also have Greg Hartman. Both these gentlemen's time is somewhat limited, and every hour we keep them here is an hour they're not working on other PERS issues, and I'm sensitive to the fact that other people are paying for their time. So, Mark, if we'll get right to your testimony as it relates to House Bill 2004, and I'm sure members will have questions.
Thank you very much. My name is Mark Johnson. I'm an actuary with Norman USA. I hope you have in front of you an actuarial impact statement dated yesterday for House Bill 2004, because I would like to go through that with you at this time. We looked at the language in House Bill 2004, and there are some gray areas that really needs more definition. And what I pointed to on the first page in the summary provisions of my statement is that there are numerous ways to transition from current set of factors to a new set. And the four that I've chosen to put in here today are four that I've already had request for information on. So as we talk through this, you may come up with other ideas, and we can certainly look at those later. First, I want to explain in terms of transition what the retirement board did last month, and they're looking at they have an open public testimony period now and adopting a rule this next month. What the retirement board said was that they would adopt new factors in January of 2004, but the comparison is going to be what they've called a look back, and that is they will not lower a benefit based upon the member's account balance at the end of 2003, and furthermore that if the member retires many years off into the future, that protection will include interest that's earned on that 2003 account balance. So that's what's called look back, including the interest on it. And I'll talk through some examples of this in a minute. But the second thing I looked at was the January 1st, 2004, except instead of including future interest on the 2003 account balance, we would just simply protect the level of benefit that's derived from the dollar amount of the 2003 account balance. I also looked at what I've called the no look back, and that is simply that the factors would apply. New factors would apply in January 2004, and there's no protection for any reduction at all. And then I was also asked to look at that same no look back provision as of January 1st, 2003, and we've done that here in this report. On the second page, I thought it would be helpful if I showed some of the factors that, in an illustrative manner, just a few ages of several factors, to give you an idea of the order of magnitude of the changes that we're talking about. The factors in the true left columns are the conversion of an account balance, and they're expressed in terms of a $1,000 account balance. For example, under old rule basis, which are the factors that are in place now for people hired before 1999, under option one, which is a non-refund life annuity, the largest benefit that can be paid for a person, there's no survivorship benefit on that at all. The benefit starts the month after you retire, and it continues until you die. For a member retiring at age 50, a $1,000 account balance will produce a monthly benefit of $7.43. If you're 55 years old, a $1,000 account balance is $7.86. Now, it's higher because you have a shorter life expectancy. You're older. So what these factors are designed to do is to spread your $1,000 account balance over your remaining lifetime with an interest discount as well. Option zero, the refund life annuity, pays for your life, but in no event will it pay less than your account balance. So there's a survivorship guarantee. If you die in the early years, your beneficiary will get a benefit. And same with option four. It's similar. It's paid for your life, but if you die in the first 15 years, the benefit will continue up to 180 payments. Well, if you look at the column under new basis, this is based upon the assumptions that are currently being used that were just adopted for the 2001 valuation. And now I'd like to just step back and describe how these factors are developed, because you may be aware that in the actuarial valuation, we're using assumed life expectancy and measuring it and using it where we have a clear classification of risk for different mortality tables. For example, we know that females tend to live longer than males. You can't say in any one individual, but as a group, females tend to live longer. Higher educated people tend to live longer than lower educated people. Police and fire tend not to live as long as general service and so forth. So we study all these categories, risk classifications separately, and we have separate assumptions for different categories. Federal law prohibits the board from having a different benefit for a different gender. So you cannot have a lower monthly benefit for a $1,000 account balance to a male retiree compared to a higher monthly benefit a lower monthly benefit for a female. We know females are going to live longer, so if you did it precisely as was done in this system prior to 1978, the female would get a lower benefit, the male would get a higher benefit. That cannot be done by law. So we have to have a way to combine the mortality assumptions. That's called blending. And what happens is that we look at the different characteristics of the group that's just ready to retire or within 5 or 10 years of retirement, and to weight these mortality tables by the characteristics of those groups. So we then come up with a unisex conversion factor. So, for example, under the new basis, at age 50, the non-refund life annuity, The new weighting, the new mortality tables, the 8% interest, produced a conversion rate of $7.21 per $1,000 account balance instead of $7.43. That's about a 3% reduction. If you look at the numbers under the straight life annuity or the non-refund life annuity, you'll see that the older you get, the bigger the percentage difference. And in fact, somebody who's 65, there's actually a dollar difference per $1,000 account balance per month, so that's about a 10% reduction. It's interesting to note out that on the left column for old rule basis, the only factors in that column that are left over from 1978 are in option one non-refund, ages 55 and above. Every other factor in that old rule basis was developed on a blended basis with 8% interest back in 1992. So although it's been reported in the press and such that PERS is using 1978 male tables, in fact, they are, but they've been changed over the years, and there's still a small group of these factors that survived, if you will, from 1978 male factors, but there are very few of them. Any questions about how we come up with the factors. I mean, this is probably a good point to place the stop and ask questions about that, if there's any questions at all about how it's done.
Well, Mark, not so much questions of how it's done, but the impetus for the change as it relates, was that the federal decision?
The change to go from a male and female sex-distinct factors into one unisex factor was the federal court case back in 1978.
But the old rule versus the new rule for 99, that impetus for change was what?
Good point. The board established an Oregon administrative rule in 1992, which said that when the actuary comes forward with a revised set of factors, and those factors are revised if we change any mortality assumption in the valuation, if we change the interest rate, or anything that would affect these factors, and those are the two primary ones. Also, how we blend them is also, you know, a factor in coming up with one single rate. That we'll go ahead and calculate those rates. The board had a rule in 1992 which said that if the actuary's conversion factors are higher, they'll adopt the higher ones. If they would reduce the benefit, they'll keep the factor the same, which is why, if you look at that on the old rule basis, age 55 is $7.86. As we recalculated the age 55 factor over the course of the last 20-plus years, we never came up with a conversion factor that was greater than $7.86 per thousand. Therefore, that's still there. Now, specifically to answer your question, what the board said was that starting in 1999, they were going to have a brand new set of factors, which I haven't shown here. But for people who were hired in 1999, they were more current factors. So because they recognized that they were lower than these factors, and in order to get them in according to their rule, they'd have to start like a new tier, almost, if you will, and start applying them for folks that were hired in 1999 and thereafter. What the board has done, again now, is to kind of back off of that process and say, well, we're going to adopt brand new factors for everybody, but they've taken the approach, instead of grandfathering these factors forever, as their old rule stated, what they're doing is they're protecting the benefit that was accrued through 2003.
So you're suggesting then that the board actually never implemented the new basis or the new rule, that they backed off of that, and so everybody will be under the new rule, but only those that have been new hires? Or
no, according to what the board did this last month, and what we expect them to finish up on this month, is they've adopted factors under the new basis.
Okay.
Only for retirements in January 2004 and after. So anybody who retires during 2003, it would not be affected. Okay. And then starting in January of 2004, there will be a comparison test. And the test will be to give the greater of the two benefits, one being whatever your benefit is on these new factors compared to what your account balance was at the end of 2003 with interest forward. And if that's still greater, the old factor times your kind of frozen account balance with interest whenever you retire, if that's still greater, you'll still get that. So essentially what the board has done is they've protected from a reduction benefit the account balance as of December 2003 with interest.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, now you said plus interest, so just so that we understand, that means that under what the board is proposing, there will be the total contributions of employers and employees for that account, and then it will continue to be factored at 8% interest ongoing.
Except for contributions that come in and make the account grow beginning in 2004 will not be covered under that protection. Contributions by the members and, of course, the match that are made in 2003 are covered by the protection, and any interest after 2003 on that 2003 account balance. But future contributions that come in and make a member's account balance grow, those contributions that come in 2004 and later will not have this protection. So basically what's going to happen is that those contributions that come in 2004 are not really going to produce any additional benefit for these members. What they're going to get is a benefit based upon their end of year 2003 account balance with interest. But the as you'll see in a minute when we show you the difference in the actuarial liabilities on these different scenarios, that is the softest landing, if you will, for the member compared to the other proposals that we've been asked to look at. In other words, it takes a longer time for the member to receive a fairly dramatic reduction like you would if you just change the factors immediately. And I guess the point on page 2 about, you know, we were asked what is the order of magnitude of these reductions, and I think you can see from this table that basically for option 1, which is a life-only annuity, it depends upon how old you are. The older you are, the bigger hit you take. Up to age 65 is a 10% reduction. Age 55 is about a 4% reduction. If you look at the other options, it's not as severe. And that is because interest plays a bigger role in option 0 and 4 than interest does in option 1. So mortality has a lesser degree of power, if you will. And the percentage change also, the other thing to remember is that we're going from the 1992 factors on these other options to the current factors. We're not going all the way back to 1978 like we are in ages 55 through 65 on the option 1. So order of magnitude of change is much less severe under option 0 or option 4. These are the only three options that are used to convert a member's account balance to a monthly annuity. If a member wishes to have a joint life benefit, in other words, if the member dies and the beneficiary is still alive, a monthly benefit continues. The account balance is converted on option 1, straight life, and then there's another conversion to the joint survivor factor. So anyone who is interested in selecting what PERS calls option 2 or 3, which is a joint life survivorship benefit, the conversion of the account balance will be done under option 1.
Representative McPherson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I want to recite what I think I'm hearing and make sure that I've got it straight. It sounds as though the transition rule used over time by the PERS board was to attach a mortality table or a set of mortality assumptions to a member, so that member stayed under that set of assumptions then throughout their career, and that the board departed from that rule most recently for the transition at 1/1/2004 by attaching it to dollars plus interest in the account. Is that a fair summary?
That's correct.
Okay.
The only minor modification to that is that in the interim, the board did take a partial step away from factors associated just with a member starting in 1999. For people hired in 1999 and thereafter, they adopted, which will disappear now, but they at the time they adopted what they called the segmented approach, which means that the factors that were developed for 1999 were in place for that service until they changed the factors. So let's say they change it every 10 years. So from 1999 through 2008, you've got one set of factors. And then for your benefit that's associated with 2009 through, say, 2018, it's a separate set of factors. So they took a step to, in your words, you know, disassociate putting a factor with a member to putting a factor with a point in time.
But your follow-up? But that segmented approach applies just to the population hired 1/1/99 forward.
That's correct.
That is that the people who are in the system before that date remained under a historical table in which they came into the system, sticking to them throughout.
That's absolutely right. And now, and under the board's approach in 2004, that will go by the wayside as well. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about, as you mentioned, protecting the account balance and interest at that point in time.
Okay. When did this particular discussion start as to changes to old rule versus new basis?
Well, we've had discussions about this since last summer when we recommended the revision to the mortality assumptions that we use in the valuation. The board had a subcommittee, the actuarial subcommittee, that studied this in some depth, and they came up to the conclusion that this process needed to be changed.
Thank you. So. Other questions? Please continue.
I've summarized the fiscal impacts at the bottom of page 3. And one of the things that I've done is that I've looked at the number of people that have retired in 2002 and are expected to retire in 2003. I didn't just look at the 2001 valuation and then assumptions that we've used from there forward, because we know that there have been about 6,600 members who retired in 2002. Our assumptions about service retirements would have produced about 4,500 retirements. We also know that based upon requests for estimates and people that have already applied for retirement so far, that the best estimate by PERS is that the number of retirements in 2003 will be 8,500 or more. I've used those figures to factor this in, in other words, looking at a transition date that's in 2004, what I've done in my work is to reduce the liability that's going to be subject to that change based upon number of retirements that have occurred during 2002 and 2003. On page 3 at the bottom, I've summarized the impacts. The other pages provide more information for legislative fiscal, but I would just like to, I guess, end with the numbers at the bottom of page 3. And that is the information that we gave the board on last month, and they've had for a number of months, is that with an effective date of January 1st of 2004, with a look back with interest, as we've talked, we would expect the unfunded liability of the system to be reduced by approximately $442 million, resulting in a reduction in employer contribution rates of 78 basis points. The estimate we gave PERS board for consideration was 80 basis points. Secondly, that if on January 1st, 2004, the look back, if you will, would be simply the account balance on 2003, not including any future interest on that 2003 account balance, the reduction in the unfunded liability would be $1,460,000,000. Resulting in a reduction in employer contribution rates of 1.97%. The estimate we gave PERS board was 2%. Then we also studied a change at January 1st, 2004 with no look back at all. And interestingly enough, there's not that much difference between protecting the account balance as of 2003 and not having a look back at all. About $100 million difference, resulting in an employer rate contribution reduction of 2.05% in our estimation. If the transition was moved forward 1 year to January 1st, 2003, slightly more savings, about $100 million additional savings, which is the difference in applying these factors to those 8,500 members that we assume are going to retire during 2003. The result would be a reduction in employer contribution rates of about 2.16% of payroll. I'd be pleased to answer any questions you might have about this report or anything else regarding the subject.
I've got a question as it relates to the tables. But first, I want to indicate to the audience that some members have trouble hearing when there are private conversations going on out in the audience, so I'd ask you to keep that to a bare minimum, and if you need to have a conversation, feel free to go out into the hall, because that tends to be less distracting than just carrying on those conversations in the back. Mark, as it relates to the old rule basis and the new rule basis and your non-refundable life annuity versus the refunded life annuity versus 15 years certain. Do you know can you tell me what percentages of people actually take those in terms of retirements?
Good question. I wish I had that in front of me. I don't. We'll get that for you. There is a fair number of people take option zero, which protects their account balance in the event of death.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned before, in order to factor in the option one, you would also need to include the number of people that take option two, 2A, or 3 and 3A, because their benefits are computed, first of all, in the option one factors. We'll get that information for you, I'm sure, before the end of the day.
Okay, great.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, how do I relate options 1, 0, and 4 to the look back with interest, look back without interest? Are they subcategories of those, or is there a one-to-one correspondence?
These are three different ways to convert a member account balance to a monthly benefit. And the differences have to do with how that monthly benefit will be stopped or continued based upon the member's death. But they all relate exactly the same way to this guarantee of the value of the 2003 account balance, for example. Let me just go over one more time what this means. If I'm 65 years old with a $1,000 account balance under the new basis, I'm going to get $8.79 per life for the rest of my life. That means that there is no survivorship benefit at all. The first of the month after I die, the benefit stops. There is just no continuation. If I live to be 110, it'll keep going until I'm 110. Option zero, again, continues to go until I'm 110 if I live that long. But if I die before the value of my account balance is paid out, so if I die in the earlier years, it tends to be about 10 to 12 years or so, then what will happen is that a beneficiary that I name will receive the difference in value in some amount. What that means is I'm adding kind of an insurance protection to the benefit that I'm taking. Therefore, when I convert my $1,000 account balance, I'm not going to get as much per month. And that difference is what's being used to finance the benefit that's going to go to the survivor.
Right.
Okay. And option four is very similar, except that instead of guaranteeing the value of the account balance being paid out, it simply says for 15 years. So that if I die in the first 15 years, somebody that I had named before I retired will receive those payments monthly until the 15 years runs out. That tends to be an interesting thing is look at it, if you're 65 and elect a 15-year certain, it costs you quite a bit. You drop all the way from $8.42 to $8.13 under option four. If you're only 50, it doesn't cost you much, $7.15 versus $7.13. That's because if you're 50 years old, there's a real good chance you're going to live 15 years. If you're 65, there's much less of a chance that you'll live 15 years. So these are all calibrated, if you will, to provide an equivalent value of benefit.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, so on page two, these are options that the member can elect at retirement. What I'm trying to understand is, do the old rule basis and new rule basis apply to the four options you're looking at, or do they apply to something else?
Yes, no, Representative Nolan, you are correct. They applied the same way to all four options, and let me give you an example. Let's say somebody had a $1,000 account balance at the time of the transition, they go on and work several more years and want to retire at age 65. At the time they retire, their account balance has now grown to $2,000. What PERS would do, they'd say, well, we're going to check $2,000 times the new basis, which is the $8.79, and compare that with $9.79 times whatever that $1,000 has grown to. Maybe it's now $1,500 with interest. So there's going to be a test that compares the old rule factor times the transition account balance, and under the first scenario that I looked at, interest on that as well, and compare that to the account balance that is actually there at retirement times the new basis, so it's the greater of the two. Under the look back without interest, no matter how long it is past the transition date, it's only going to go back and look at $1,000, what my account balance was at 2003, multiplied by my age 65 when I retire, $9.79. Well, if my account balance is now $2,000, that times $8.79 is going to be a lot larger than going all the way back and using my $1,000 account balance back from 2003 times an even greater factor. So this protection will tend to wear away faster if you don't include interest in the protection. So the protection, then that's why the cost impact, there's a much smaller difference or savings, if you will, under the approach that the board took, because what's being protected is not only the account balance, but it's that protection is growing with interest.
And one final follow-up, Mr. Chair. When you say interest, you include all earnings on the account, whether they are interest or appreciation or
no
matter how that account is invested, capital gains on that account would be included.
Right. It's the amount available to credit to member accounts under Tier 1. That's currently the assumed rate of interest, so it'll be 8% minimum guarantee. Under Tier 2, there's no guarantee. Actually lost money the last few years, but when I say interest credited, what I mean is the interest that's credited by PERS to member accounts, regardless of how that's come about, whether it's through investment gains or losses, bonds, real estate returns, and so forth. It's a portfolio rate of return that's available.
Thank you.
Representative Richardson and then Representative McPherson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, just to boil this down to something that's very easily understood, am I correct from your computations that if new mortality tables are put in place effective January 1 of this year, the unfunded liability will be diminished by $1,667,000,000. And is that correct?
That's correct.
And that the employer rates of what will have to be paid against the unfunded liability will reduce by 2.16%.
The total employer rate is reduced by 2.16%. Part of that is a normal cost, in other words, the ongoing cost of benefits that are being earned. Back on page 7, you can see the differences. Of that 2.16%, 1.57 is a reduction due to the amortization of the $1,667,000,000, and 0.59% of payroll is a reduction in the average normal cost.
Okay, thank you.
So.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I want to confirm something I think I heard earlier. We don't have an illustration of the cost impact or effect on unfunded liability and employer rates of a look back without interest as of January 1, 2003, but I think I understood you to say that there was about the same differential that exists in these numbers as of 1104 would probably apply approximately if we were looking at that differential at 1103. Is that right?
Right. I have not run those numbers, but that's, my best estimate would be approximately $100 million less.
Mm-hmm. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
What is the proportion of retirees currently leaving the system who are at each of the respective ages that are illustrated on page 2, that is ages 50, 55, 60, and 65? And I don't expect that you would necessarily have tracked that precisely, but just maybe an approximate feel as to what the prevailing age is for people leaving the system?
Well, the average age is less than 60. I believe it's somewhere between 58 and 59. At least it was several years ago. We'll certainly go back and look at that, give that information to you. We also... Steve Delaney is giving me the latest financial report of the system, and it does have in it on page 61 the numbers of individuals that have retired on these different options, and we'll summarize that for you in a table and show you that amount as well.
Okay. As the first actuary, did you give a recommendation to the board as to which method to adopt of the four methods that we have before us that you've done a actuarial projection on?
The PERS board had in front of it, they had developed through their committee just the first two, the look back with interest and the look back without interest. They received advice from the Department of Justice and did not ask for my advice.
Thank you. Any other questions? Did you have more?
No.
Greg does.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. On a going forward basis, the bill that we have in front of us calls for an update every 2 years, and I wanted to get comments about how frequently mortality needs to be revisited. Is that a reasonable schedule to have mortality updated in the system?
Representative McPherson, I believe it's reasonable to look at it every 2 years because the statute requires us to analyze the experience every 2 years. We don't know ahead of time when we'll be changing mortality. History has shown us that there has been a long trend of improved life expectancy in this country, and mortality assumptions are generally change enough so that over a course of about a decade, you can measure the difference and feel like you need to strengthen your reserves. That's what happened this last time. And just to be clear that when we're financing the system, we're not just looking at the actual death rates that just occurred in the previous four-year period, which we studied. We're also trying to have a margin in there so that we have some protection if the trend continues to improve, people living longer and longer. So we have built those margins in. But I would not expect to have to change to mortality assumptions more often than every 8 to 10 years. But I do think it's a good idea to look at it. We'll be doing an experience study, and it certainly is no burden for the actuary to say, well, if we haven't changed interest and we haven't changed mortality, there's no need to change the factors. But at least you've required the actuary to look at it. I think that's probably a good idea.
Mark, do you is there a table that most private pension funds use, like a guide? And have you recommended a potential table for use, or do you recommend that be in bill form, or that be adopted later by the board?
Observer Canelpe, the way that we're able to study mortality with the state of Oregon is different than most private plans because there are so many retirees. For the largest state retirement systems, there are enough retirees to develop your own mortality table. In fact, we do that for California teachers. There are enough retirees to develop our own death rates example for at every age. What we do with the experience of Oregon is we look at the latest nationally published tables, and the one we've used in this last study is the RP2000 table published by the Society of Actuaries just recently. And we've measured the actual death rates in the for the last 4 years from Oregon retirees against that table, and then we've made minor adjustments to that table so that it is the best fit possible. I would think that for a system this large, it would be a mistake to put into statute which mortality table we should be using. In fact, one of my other clients, the state of Montana, just recently...
Yep. We're going to stand in recess.
We're going to call the hearing back to order, the House Public Employee Retirement System. My understanding is that Tom is lucid and alert and actually recognized the chair and his representative, so I think for the time being things will be fine, but there obviously was quick attention since we have some medical personnel in the room today, so thankful for that. We were in the middle of Mark Johnson answering a question as regards to materiality tables, and you might, I believe the question related to whether or not we should put the mortality table issue in statute or best left to the board.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I was about to give the example of one of my other clients, the state of Montana, where the legislature in that state had put the mortality table in the statute. It was a 1983 table, had been there. When we were hired as new actuary for Montana, we felt that that wasn't the true actuarial equivalence, and it required going back to the legislature, convincing them that the tables needed to be upgraded, and it took a while to get that taken care of. I think if you believe the trend that life expectancies may continue to improve over time, that by actually putting the mortality table into the statute, and how these factors are developed, that will eventually be outdated. And for that reason, I believe it's more prudent to require the board's independent actuary to look at the issue and to use his or her best judgment to make a recommendation.
Does it make sense to put in times for updating, 2 years or 4 years, or...
Mr. Chair, I believe the statute is, or the bill as proposed, calls for the review every 2 years. I believe that's consistent because another part of the statute calls for the actuary to review the experience, the mortality experience, every 2 years in developing assumptions for the valuation. Well, if we're going to do that every 2 years, and as I mentioned before, we don't change it every 2 years, but we do look at it every 2 years. So that by having at least something in the bill that says that the actuary shall take a look at this at the same time we're doing an experience study, it makes sense to me.
If you found an experience that appeared as though life expectancies are living longer, would you recommend that the tables be updated at that point as an actuary?
Yes.
Have you recommended in the past, I mean, even the actuary for quite some time, have you recommended in the past the BFAs?
Yes.
And was that just not taken up at that point? Or?
Well, that's going back, we've been the actuaries since the late 70s, and we were involved in changing the factors, as I mentioned before, in 79. The next time it was looked at, it was about 10 years later. And at that point in time, the improved life expectancy was offset by an increase in the assumed interest rate. If you have a longer life expectancy, you should get a smaller monthly benefit per $1,000. But if the interest rate goes from 7% to 8%, you should get a larger benefit. Those offset each other. So the first time we actually came and recommended significant changes was in the early 90s. And that's the point at which the board made the rule that said we're not going to lower the benefits, we're only going to raise them. Then the next time we came back and looked at it is when the board said, well, okay, but we're going to protect these benefits, but we'll start this new arrangement beginning with people who were hired in 1999. And then this is the next time we've come forward, and they've agreed to the changes that at least everybody will be on the new tables, although there's a the protections that they put in were significant. As I recall, and you should ask the PERS director this, but when I said a few minutes ago, somebody asked me if I had made a recommendation. The staff did recommend the look back without interest, and I had talked to the staff in the weeks before the board meeting and agreed with that. So, in answer to your question, I think it was right. I mean, I didn't make a recommendation to the board, but the board already had a staff recommendation in front of them.
But in 1992, you said they increased benefits. Now, usually updating the mortality tables means that the benefits decrease. Am I not correct on that?
Well, but in 1992, we changed mortality, but we also increased the interest assumption from 7.5 to 8. So that change did make a difference. And if you look on page 2 of the letter that I have in front of you today, under the old rule basis, all of the factors for option 0 and all of the factors for option 4 were put into place in 1992. In addition, all of the factors at age 54 and below under option 1 were put into place in 1992. So they did follow my recommendation, but at that time, because of the interest rate was 7.5 to 8, there was some modest increases in these factors back in 1992.
Any other questions? I was under the impression that the interest rate changed in 89. Am I wrong on that?
No, you're absolutely correct. The interest rate changed in the valuation of December 31st, 1989. The next time we looked at these factors was based upon that assumption change, but it actually didn't get implemented until 1992.
Okay. Thank you.
The 1992 referred to the date they were implemented, not the effective date of when the assumptions changed.
Right. Any questions? Thank you.
Well,
Greg.
Excuse me, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Greg Hartman, and I'm the attorney for the Hearst Coalition. I understand I was asked to come down and talk about the somewhat broad topic of contract rights, and particularly how those may relate to the actuarial issue that you're currently studying. I sent down a letter, I actually had it emailed down this morning, and I understand you all have copies of it, which I had actually prepared before being asked to come today. It incorporates within it two other letters, and both of those are copies of written testimony that I gave to the Hearst Board during the course of their consideration of the rules that Mr. Johnson was just talking about. So hopefully you will find that interesting, edifying, but I don't intend to read through it. Which is, I hope, good news. So let me talk a little bit, if I may, about the concept of contract rights, because it's talked about a lot, but quite often we don't spend time to just take a moment and talk about it. In the public sector in the state of Oregon, our courts have basically developed a notion of the protection of pension benefits based on common law unilateral contract concepts. Now, a unilateral contract, in law school they used to give this example, is if I say to you, I will pay you $50 to cross the bridge, and I say that to someone else, and that person accepts that by beginning to cross the bridge, by actually performing, that's what the courts call a unilateral contract. And I may not change my mind when you're halfway across the bridge and say, never mind. You are entitled to the full $50, assuming you complete performance, which in that case is crossing the bridge. Purely a common law concept. You don't look in a statute and find anything about unilateral contracts. But the basis for the court's development of a law in this area is the concept of unilateral contract. Very, very different from the private sector. Since the early 70s, when we had ERISA passed, some people refer to it as the Pension Reform Act, developments in the private sector have been basically based on statutes, very specific statutes, which for the most part do not apply to the public sector, and much of which has been incorporated into the Internal Revenue Code. So we have two really different bodies of law based on very different sources. As I say, the private sector being very specific to the statutes, the public sector being based on this notion of unilateral contract. Now, I'm not going to talk about a lot of cases. There are probably 15 to 20 cases in the state of Oregon which have developed this concept in one way or another. And by the way, I should say that Oregon is very much in the mainstream of how this is developed in other states. So by no means is Oregon substantially different from most other states who have developed the same concepts for the protection of public sector pensions in their state. The two cases I want to talk about, because I think they will illustrate how the unilateral contract concept works. First is the Hughes case. In response to a U.S. Supreme Court case which came out in the, I think in 1989, the Oregon legislature decided to begin taxing the benefits of PERSE retirees. Now, since virtually the inception of PERSE, there had been a portion of the PERSE statute that said we won't tax these benefits. But in response to the Supreme Court case, which said you can't tax federal retirees if you don't tax state retirees, the legislature decided to go ahead and begin imposing that tax. That was challenged, and that challenge ended up in the Supreme Court and was decided in the Hughes case. The court went back and reviewed a great deal of the other case law, and if you read the case, it'll give you some sense of how the court got to the unilateral contract concept. But in that case, the court said several things. Number one, it said for the first time, specifically, that PERSE, in fact, was a unilateral contract. That was, frankly, no great surprise. That was very consistent with case law.
That was in Hughes?
That was in Hughes, 1992 or thereabouts, give or take a year or two. Number two, they said the promise of an exemption from taxes was also contractual in nature. You can go through that case and see how they wrestled to see whether that particular part of the statute was contractual in nature. But they said the legislature can breach that contract if they care to, but they have to provide a remedy for that breach. And so that was as far as Hughes went. Now, Hughes threw us a little curve, because the judges, when looking at the taxing statute and reading it as carefully as only judges can, said, in fact, this particular statute only protects benefits accrued or accruing, but the legislature did not give up its right to tax benefits which are based on performance in the future. Now, I was one of the attorneys who argued that, and I will tell you, none of the attorneys in that case argued that, so the judges figured that out on their own and came up with this kind of unusual ruling. So at the end of the Hughes case, what we had was, PERSE was a contract, this particular provision was a contract, and there had to be a remedy for the breach of that contract because of the legislature's decision to start taxing. Now, that eventually worked out in House Bill 3349, which I know you've already heard evidence on, so I won't spend a lot of time talking about that, but I do want to talk about one other case, and it's the Measure 8 case. And I'm sure you recall in 94, if I remember correctly, the electorate passed Measure 8, which did three things. It said for all public sector pension plans in the state of Oregon, you cannot use sick leave to enhance your final benefit. You cannot guarantee the rate of return on any investment within a pension plan. And number three, every public sector employee has to contribute 6% of his or her salary to their pension, and that may not be picked up by employers. Even though it was addressed broadly to all pension plans, it was clearly directed at PERSE because these are specific PERSE provisions. Now, the court basically held Measure 8 to be void. The court ruled unanimously that the first two, the taking away the sick leave and taking away the guarantee, were in fact impairments of contract and therefore void. And I think, if I remember correctly, by a 4-3 vote, held that the 6%, saying that employees had to pay 6%, was also void. The important thing about that case, well, the two things. Number one, again, you can look at it to see how the court goes through the process of determining what is part of that contract. But the other very important part of that case is that the state tried to save Measure 8 by arguing it was okay to provide apply it prospectively to benefits yet to be earned. And they cited back to the Hughes case and said to the court, look what you did in Hughes, that's consistent with the theory that we can do this prospectively. In the Measure 8 case, the Oregon State Police case, and they're cited in the memo, so you have the citations if you want to review them, the court very specifically rejected that argument and said, no, you misread Hughes. Hughes meant to talk is not meant to be expanded beyond its very specific terms on that issue. And consistent with unilateral contract law, just like crossing the bridge, once you start in service, once you become a public employee and you are promised a certain pension benefit, whatever that happens to be, then you are entitled to receive that full pension benefit at the end of your career. Again, very similar to the crossing the bridge analogy. And so the court rejected the notion that we could apply new rules, if you will, or limit pension benefits prospectively, said that is inconsistent with Oregon law. Again, very, very similar to rulings in other states in these kind of challenges. So if you only read two cases in an attempt to have a better understanding of contract law in the area of public sector pension, I would recommend those two cases. Now, there are others out there. There are some older cases. This case law didn't start in the early 90s. It goes back into the 40s as it started developing. But they really will give you some sense of where the court is on this topic. And we've really had no additional major cases before the Supreme Court since the Measure 8 case in 95 or 96, whenever that was decided. So that's the current state of the law. Now, how does that fit in with actuarial factors? If you think about it, what PERS has done for the last 25 years, setting aside what they're currently doing, but what they've done since 1978 on actuarial factors is absolutely consistent with this notion of unilateral contract law, which has been the law which has been that the courts have adopted for the protection of pension rights. Because I think, as Representative McPherson said, a set of actuarial factors is attached to an individual. It's kind of hung on your jacket. And as you go through the system, the thinking up to this point has been that is the set of actuarial factors that will govern on the day that you retire. So the current rule, the last 25 years, the adoption of the rule in 92 or 93, which said we will not change those factors unless they are beneficial, because you can always change to do something a little better. You simply can't go backwards. Are all consistent with basically how the courts have analyzed contract rights in the state of Oregon. Let me divert for a minute, because what I'm always asked at this point is, I don't understand why, if people are living longer and we pay them a little bit lower benefit, but over the course of their lifetimes it works out to be the same, why anybody would consider that to be a lowering of benefits. The response to that is twofold. First of all, PERS is a defined benefit plan. And by that I mean that PERS basically is a plan designed to produce a monthly benefit for people upon retirement. It's got three different methodologies for doing that and multiple options once you've calculated that benefit. But like all defined benefit plans, it is designed to produce a discernible benefit at retirement. Let me contrast a defined contribution plan, typical 401k plan that probably all of you are familiar with to a greater or lesser degree. A defined contribution plan is designed to produce an account. I put money in, my employer puts money in, it's invested, it has some earnings, and at the end of the day when I retire, what I get is what's in my account, period. I might take that in a lump sum. My employer might go out into the market and buy an annuity for me based on whatever annuity rates are available at that time. But the target, if you will, of the two different plans is very, very different. Now, let me back up and talk about that. You know, why is it a lowering of benefits if people are living longer? The courts have actually addressed that issue in a couple of cases. It has not been addressed by the state courts in the state of Oregon. It has been addressed in other courts in other states and has been addressed, I think, implicitly in our state, and let me tell you why. What the court has said is that when determining whether there has been a change in a plan, which is going to result in a question of whether there's a contract breach, we do not make comparisons in the aggregate. In other words, we do not say, if we take this batch of people and we make this assumption about how long they're going to live, and we have another batch and we make assumptions about them, we don't make those comparisons with groups of people. What the courts have said is comparisons have to be on an individual basis. And I referenced the Sheffield case, which is again cited in the memo. It happens to be an Alaska case, but again, a case where the court was very specifically looking at the issue of a change in actuarial factors in Alaska PERS, rejected that change, and rejected the argument that, you know, people are living longer, lower benefit, it all works out, because they said we're not going to go to that kind of aggregate analysis. Pension analysis is on an individual basis in a defined benefit plan. Also, if you look back, and I referenced the Henderson case. Henderson is the case that was decided in the District of Oregon in 1978 or thereabouts, in which held that it was impermissible to use separate actuarial tables for males and females. Very, very common in the late 70s that pension plans had these differing tables. And Judge Solomon, or one of our district court judges at that time, said that was impermissible. And if you think about it, he implicitly rejected this aggregate analysis. Because if we could analyze in the aggregate, as Mr. Johnson pointed out to you just a few minutes ago, we know that even today, less so than back in 1978, women tend to live longer. And so if we were to apply an aggregate analysis, it would be permissible to pay them a lower benefit under the theory that on average they're going to live longer, as opposed to males who on average, unfortunately, do not live quite as long. So I think when you look at those cases, and they're cases decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, and all of them have rejected that kind of approach to analyzing whether there are differences in benefits which are of concern in either a contract analysis or in those cases in a discrimination analysis. Now, interestingly, if you are a participant in a 401k plan, and let's say that you have a male and female employee who start on exactly the same day, put exactly the same amount of money away, and on their retirement date have exactly the same amount of money in their accounts, the female employee will not be able to buy as high an annuity as the male employee, but the courts have never held that to be a problem. And the reason is because when the court looks at it, they say, in a defined contribution context, what you're doing is simply building up an account balance. And the account balance will buy what it buys, and if you happen to be in a class that lives longer, and if you happen not to be able to buy so much, that is nothing that is going to be of concern to the courts. So that, in a nutshell, is currently where the state of Oregon is in terms of contract analysis and how that applies in the public sector. Now, if I can depart that, and I'm happy to answer any questions, so fire away if anyone has anything, so if I'm not clear on this.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hartman, if we do not look at retirement in the aggregate, and we look at an individual basis, and if everything is kind of determined based on the individual as far as their mortality table when they are hired, then why would not a person who was hired in 1972 have the assumed earnings rate of 3.75%, since that was the rate that applied in 1972 instead of 8%, which came on at a subsequent time?
It's a good question, and it's an interesting question, and in a sense that is what has happened in PERS, because Mark Johnson mentioned a few minutes ago that what has happened since 1978 is we have a number of factors which still exist in the plan which are based on 1978 mortality and based on 1978 earnings, which at that time were 7%. They weren't 3.5%, but they were 7%. And so we have exactly what you're suggesting already, at least in part, in the plan. We really have kind of a mishmash, frankly, if I can use that technical legal expression, of factors currently in the plan. Some of them are old 78 factors based on 7% assumptions. Some are on more current factors and more current earnings assumptions. On a hypothetical basis, I think that consistent with the Oregon case law, you could do precisely what you propose. And to say that the day that you join the system, we're going to lock certain things in. We're going to lock in mortality. We're going to lock in earnings, at least those that will be used for calculating your benefit once you get to retirement. PERS has not done that, but I think on a theoretical basis, you could conceivably run a pension plan that way. Now, you may raise other problems, but from the perspective of getting by the Oregon Supreme Court, I don't think you'd have a problem with that approach, at least on this limited issue we're discussing.
Follow up. The difficulty I'm having is it seems like if it works for the raising of benefits, then it can be changed as time goes on. But if it would work in the benefit, or, you know, in the benefit of the employer, then it's not going to be allowed to apply. And I just can't see how that works.
It's the unilateral contract concept. And again, if I can go back to my bridge analogy, if I've made an offer to you, if you cross the bridge, I'll pay you $50, and you're halfway across, and I shout out, I'll pay you $60, the courts would say, that's all right, and I'm now obligated to pay you $60, but what I can't do is shout out when you're halfway across, never mind, I'd rather only pay you $40. So you're absolutely right. Unilateral contract analysis only goes one way. It does not permit, it doesn't permit the dollars to go down. It does permit the dollars to go up, and as a matter of fact, using my example, and there's a case called the Taylor against Multnomah County case decided in the early 70s, where, if you pardon me for using the bridge example, that's exactly what happened. Partway through a person's career, the benefits were increased. Similarly, I'll pay you $60 when you're halfway across the bridge. And then Multnomah County basically wanted to say, never mind, we really didn't mean to do it quite that way, and the court said no. Even though the person entered employment upon a promise of, $50, and partway through her career, you changed it to offer $60, you're now stuck with the $60, and you may not go backwards. So I agree with you. It's a very one-way methodology, and it's not a methodology which balances back and forth. And it's partly because of the oddity of a unilateral contract, because it's different from a bilateral contract. If you and I sit and negotiate and we make an agreement and we both sign it, that's an agreement that we've both worked on. Unilateral, though, is just this concept of my saying to you, if you perform a certain service, for instance, I'll pay you something, and you don't sit down and sign an agreement with me, you just start performing the service. And the courts have been very protective of that, and in fact, you're absolutely right, have allowed it to move up, but will not allow it to move down.
Is it your opinion, then, that you could set up a pension system that would have a bilateral element to it?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So as long as it's stated.
Yeah, a contract is just a contract. And I think that the, for instance, again, let me go to the public sector, or private sector, if you will, and go to the collective bargaining concept. Almost all of our contracts are based on bilateral collectively bargained agreements. And those can be amended. Now, you have more flexibility in the private sector, but again, you could have that kind of concept. We have not in the state of Oregon, and for the most part around the country, that has not been the analysis the courts have used when getting into these things. I'm often asked, for instance, well, could you bargain changes in PERS? You know, could we go to the bargaining table and say, all right, we'd like to think about making some tweaks? And people ask me whether you can do that. Of course, part of my response is, I don't know, because we really have not had a ruling on that. But at least on a theoretical basis, there's no reason why there could not be a change in a unilateral contract as long as both parties agreed. Again, going to my bridge analogy, if you're halfway across and I say, hey, I'm a little short, will you do it for 40? And you wave back and say, hey, that's fine. I think the courts would say, that's fine. You can do that.
Was the 6% collectively bargained the pickup?
The 6% is mandatory in the statute. The pickup is a matter of collective bargaining in circumstances where you have collective bargaining. Because remember, pickup is often in place for management employees as well, and for people who don't have collective bargaining. But in a collective bargaining context, you're absolutely right. The 6% is a collectively bargained item.
Okay, so the 6% in statute is in statute. And so you would refer to that as unilateral, part of the unilateral contract. Pension contract, is that right?
Yes, I would say so. The 6% requirement, the requirement that every member contribute 6%, is in the statute.
The fact that the employers pick up that 6%, that was collectively bargained, so you'd consider that bilateral.
Correct. And historically, for instance, at the time that Measure 8 passed, and really since then, some employees and employers have bargained to remove the pickup. People bargain it in, people bargain it out, and I think it can be bargained either way. Now, for those who are not in a collective bargaining group, it becomes a little different because you're going to have to make a separate contract. But I agree that that's clearly something intended to be subject to bilateral contract making.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hartman, under your view of the unilateral contract theory, then what is the defensibility of the PERS board decision to implement the rule with on a look back without with interest basis?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that. And if I may kind of edge up to the answer rather than answering it directly, what's really happened in the last 2 years that PERS has been studying this issue is a search, if I can, for a new way of thinking about this issue and perhaps a new way of thinking about it in the context of a unilateral contract. And that search included meetings with stakeholders and testimony and many, many things that went on and a variety of proposals. What has happened at this point is several meetings ago, the PERS board decided to implement new tables on a fixed date. They didn't pick the date, but they said, we're going to do it on a fixed date, and we'll figure out what that date's going to be. And they started down a different path than they had ever been on before, because when the draft of the rule came out, they began talking about the protection of what were called accrued benefits. Now, accrued benefit is a well-understood concept in the private sector, but it's not a concept that you often see in the public sector because, again, the protections are more powerful, or putting it another way, the restrictions are more powerful against changes in the public sector than the private sector. And so what PERS began doing, really, I think, was studying how this would play out were we in the private sector. And if you look at my memo or testimony, the second one, which is dated December 10, what I was doing in that memo was saying, look, if we're going to borrow a concept from the private sector, the accrued benefit concept, and apply it in this circumstance, then the question is, how does that work in the private sector? And so the reason I wrote that memo was to go through the step-by-step process of saying, if we were in the private sector and if we are applying this concept, this is how I think it comes out. Now, of course, I don't know whether DOJ agrees with me or not, since they don't share their opinions with me. But it would appear, given the repartee that took place at the last PERS board meeting, that DOJ has come down pretty much the same place I did. If we're going to adopt the accrued benefit approach, I mean, maybe they have an altogether different approach and we just happen to end up in the same place. I don't know that because, again, they don't share their thinking with me. So my belief is what the PERS board is doing right now is borrowing a concept from the private sector. Now, is that going to pass muster with the Oregon Supreme Court? I don't know. You're going to have to convince the Oregon Supreme Court, it seems to me, to either abandon their unilateral contract basis, which appears pretty unlikely because it's well embedded in the law of not only this state but many others, or alternatively convince the court that in the case of actuarial factors, they're somehow different and therefore there's a different rule that needs to be applied, and then arguably make the argument that the accrued benefit protection is the correct rule to apply in this circumstance. Now, I don't know, I've not as yet done the research, although I'm having it done right now. I don't know whether any other state has done that. In other words, I don't know whether any other state, when looking at this kind of issue, has decided to apply the accrued benefit concept from the private sector and apply it to a public sector plan where we've had a traditional unilateral contract analysis. But it seems to me that if that's the approach, that's ultimately what someone's going to have to convince the Supreme Court of, is to change the way they look at this.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Follow up. Is it your view that it would be within the power of the legislature to establish a unilateral contract that is limited on an accrual basis, say for a new hire? Could a statute say the promise is incremental for as long as you're working under the system, but until we decide to change it on a going forward basis? Or is it your view that once the despite whatever the legislature might say in the terms of the offer, that offer becomes binding as soon as the employee embarks on performance?
No, I think it's very much within the legislature's power, for instance, to say to new hires, this is going to be the unilateral contract, but we retain certain rights to change that contract, depending on, for instance, changes in mortality, things of that nature. If you think back to the Hughes case, that's exactly what the court found that the legislature did in giving up their taxing authority, is they said that the legislature only gave it up for benefits accrued or accruing, but did not give it up for future benefits. Now, it's hard to find that in the statute, but that's what the Supreme Court said. But I think if the legislature clearly stated that, I don't think there's any question the legislature can do that, and I don't find that at all inconsistent with unilateral contract theory, because you said on the front end, this is the deal. And I think the key issue is clearly identifying what the deal is on the front end, and then whatever that is, and if the legislature retains the power either directly or through the board to make changes, then that's the deal on the front end. Everybody knows it. So I think you could design whatever restrictions you wanted to, I think probably within some reason, or whatever restrictions the legislature cared to put in there, and I think that'd be entirely consistent with unilateral contract theory.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. You have questions?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
When you talk about, Mr. Hartman, when you talk about unilateral contracts, you said those are not actually signed.
They typically
occur by initiating a service, something of value.
Mm-hmm.
Does PERS have a unilateral does PERS have 290,000 different unilateral contracts? Does it have an individual unilateral contract with each active and inactive member?
Actually, interestingly enough, the courts have said the unilateral contract does not run between the member and PERS. It runs between the member and the employer. PERS administers the contract, but the contracting parties are the employer and the employee. And in answer to your question, yes, I think you could say that there are 290,000 separate contracts, but they are with 800 separate employers, all administered by PERS.
If an employee works for 5 years and becomes vested, or 10 years and becomes vested, and quits, goes to the private sector, if the law has changed in the meantime, is it your belief that they would come back under the unilateral contract that they started with when they first had their employment, or would they come back under the changes that have been made to PERS, and they would be accepting then the new contract?
And I hate to say it, but I have to give you the usual attorney answer: it depends. And I'll tell you what it depends on in my mind. PERS has some very specific statutes which permit the bridging of periods of not working within the system. And I think if you fall within one of those bridging statutes, in other words, you've only been gone so many years, then I think the best argument would be that they would be entitled to return on whatever basis existed at the time they departed the system. If, on the other hand, they're outside the scope of that, even though they may have a vested account, then I think they would return based on whatever was in existence at the system at the time that they returned. So I think it's really a question, again, of what the statute has promised, because if you have an existing promise that under certain circumstances you have an absolute right to come back into the system, then I think that right probably attaches to the benefit which existed at the time you departed.
What if the legislature changes those bridging statutes when they're gone?
Two levels of analysis. First of all, you'd have to determine whether those are part of the contractual promise. In other words, is that part of the deal? And we have no case law on that in the state of Oregon. So, that we'd have to look at it and go through the kind of analysis that takes place. And the answer, of course, is if it's part of the deal, you can't change it. If it's not part of the deal, you can. And I don't think every single part of PERS is necessarily, quote, part of the deal. I mean, for instance, I testified in favor of House Bill 2001 the other day, which in essence was a strengthening of the reserving systems, and I believe that the legislature is well within their power to strengthen reserving systems, even though that may have an adverse impact on, arguably, on benefits, without running afoul of that. I think the court would say that's well within the power of the legislature to do that, even though it does have the impact of potentially keeping some benefits down just a bit.
Do you think that same rule applies as it relates to investments and the ability to remove some of the significant swings in it in investment earnings?
If you're referring to partitioning, which I think is...
I am. I'll get clear.
Yeah, I've scratched my head over that one for some time, because when partitioning first was suggested, the idea that you divide the investments and attach them more specifically to certain classes of employees, I kind of said, you know, if this is just a mechanism of getting around the guarantee or lowering the guarantee, it seems to me like it's in trouble, because it would seem to be just kind of trying to get around what is a contractual promise. And we already know from the Measure 8 case that, for instance, the 8% is a contractual promise that's been established. I'm still scratching my head about the partition. I have to say my current impression is if the only reason you were doing it was to lower that 8% guarantee, I think that's problematical. But on the other hand, again, if there are other things to be accomplished by doing that, then I think there's at least a chance of convincing the court that those are more akin to the strengthening of the reserving system, even though it has an adverse impact on benefits, rather than simply a lowering of what appears to be a promised guarantee.
More questions down here? Question. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Hartman, would you give us the benefit of your analysis as far as Judge Lipscomb's opinion relating to allocation and the board's choices as far as whether they were going to allocate full amounts or partial amounts, since there were reserves that were already supposed to, you know, there was a procedure for laying out reserves?
Thank you. Actually, I had meant to mention Judge Lipscomb and I overlooked it, so thank you. On that issue, what the judge found was that it was an abuse of discretion, in his opinion, for the PERS board to allocate as much of the 1999 earnings to individual accounts as they did. Now, the evidence that was before the judge was somewhat limited on that issue. I was there, so I'll tell you the history of how this came about. Prior to 1999, for the most part, the board had attempted to maintain a reserve of 24 months, assuming new earnings. So that, you know, works out to a 12% reserve, 16% reserve. There was a study done for the Oregon Investment Council, which was made available to the board, and in that study, the Russell Company, who did the study, suggested that they believed a 30-month reserve would be more appropriate, though interestingly enough, they also said in that study that going beyond 30 would not appear to add any additional stability to the system. The board, in effect, adopted the recommendation of the Russell study and said, we think that 30 should be our target. But the board continued to do really what they had done for many years in the past, and that is when the reserving target changed, they didn't necessarily go to that new target all at one time. They had always taken a step-by-step approach. And so they selected the allocation they did in 1999, which allowed them to go partway towards the 30-month goal, not all the way. And Judge Lipscomb was critical of that, in part because he said the state did not fully explain why they didn't go all the way to 30 months. In other words, the money was available. There were sufficient 1999 earnings that they could have gone from 24 months to 30 months in one time. And the judge felt that there had not been sufficient explanation for why they had chosen to take this gradual approach rather than just leaping from one to the other. So that was Judge Lipscomb's thinking on that issue. If I may, since you raised Judge Lipscomb, I do want to make one point about Judge Lipscomb's decision. it only directly affects 7 employers and 8 employees. And I know there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, how does that decision play out? And, of course, I would not pretend to forecast that I can say with specificity how that will play out. But technically speaking, right now, it affects a limited population before PERS. Judge Lipscomb did not order, for instance, the reallocation of the 1999 funds for everybody that's in the system. That would have been beyond his authority because he only had 8 employers and 7 employees in front of him. So as we go through this process, and, of course, Judge Lipscomb's opinion is on appeal, and presumably the courts will sort through it and decide how much of it eventually survives. But it is an opinion really only affecting directly 8 employers, 7 employers, and 8 employees. Now, whether at some point when that opinion, assuming it survives appeal, if it comes back down to the PERS board, can they open it up and do it more broadly? I don't know. I think there's some significant limitations to the board doing that. So. Judge Lipscomb said some very broad things in his opinion, but his judgment is very narrow. So, and also the other thing I have to say, that Judge Lipscomb, again, without being critical of the judge, I disagree with him in many respects, but I'm not going to be critical of him. Many of the issues that we're discussing here were not reached in that opinion. And so we're not, even assuming the Supreme Court rules on it, we're not going to get any definitive analysis on things like contract rights. We never even got to the level of discussing contract rights, for instance, in Judge Lipscomb's court. His analysis was limited to a review of the administrative decisions of the board. Contract rights won't arise until we go all the way back down to the board, and the board says, how do we implement this? Because can we implement this without having an adverse impact? So many, many issues which are going to be of concern to this group were simply not addressed in Judge Lipscomb. Can I make one other very, very quick point? Unless there's a question?
No, go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to point out the other memo in the packet and explain why it's there. And that's the memo dated in December. It's December December 10th. Thank you. One of the issues that Mr. Johnson referred to is how you construct an actuarial table. And he referred to the blending of male and female and other factors in order to come up with a table. I wrote that memo to the PERS board to remind them that in 1978, when they settled the Henderson case, and a Henderson case was a case against Oregon PERS, alleging that it was improper to use separate male and female tables, that they had committed to use what are called, well, they committed to use male-only tables, often referred to as topping up. And that had been a very common reaction to the decisions in the latter 70s saying you couldn't use separate tables. What I call to the board's attention is there is still an outstanding federal district court order mandating the board to use topped up tables. Now it appears that for most of the last 25 or so years since that was issued that the board has been ignoring that particular order because, as Mark Johnson says, we now have a very peculiar blend of some topped up 7%, some 1992 blended. It's really a mishmash. But I raised that to the board simply because if we are now stepping completely away from topped up, there will no longer be any topped up factors, and if we are going to apply those factors to service, which may have been all the way back in 1978, because of course people who are new to the system are just now reaching retirement age, it seems to me there's an enormous problem with not being in compliance with Judge Solomon's order. So that's another whole issue that I think you're going to have to wrestle with in this. Every time you turn around, there's another issue. But that's to make a determination as to whether the board continues to have some residual obligation to use male-only tables in order to remain consistent with Judge Solomon's order, particularly if you're going to adopt an approach which does not give some method of look-back protection for service which was, during the time, protected by Judge Solomon's order. So again, I'm not going to go into that in any depth. I just wanted to kind of highlight that. You can read through the memo and it'll give you some history, background, and so forth of this issue. And it is a very important issue. As a matter of fact, dollar and cents-wise, it is probably a bigger issue than going to current mortality tables. In other words, when we talk about the savings that are being affected, it is apart from going to current mortality, perhaps as importantly, it's from going from mail-only tables to some form of blended table. So it is a significant dollar and cents issue as well as being a significant legal issue.
Representative Kapoor, do you have a question?
Yes, and you may have partially answered this, but bear with me. Is it your opinion that we, the legislature, could make any changes to the mortality tables, or would that be in violation of the contract?
I don't want to say that the legislature can make no changes, and as a matter of fact, my clients, the PERS Coalition, have supported certain changes. But I think that what you're going to have to do as you go through this process of considering what changes you think are appropriate is to keep in mind that there's going to have to be a legal theory for why those particular changes, whatever they may end up being at the end of the day, how is that going to survive review in the Supreme Court? And so I think that as you go through this process, you need to be thinking about what is the new legal theory. In other words, why are actuarial factors different and therefore should not be subject to the kind of classic unilateral contract analysis? Why should we handle this issue a little differently and convince the court that that's the appropriate way to do? So I don't want to say never, because, again, that's not the position we've taken as a coalition. But I think it's going to take some careful craftsmanship and some careful thinking about what is going to be the new legal theory which will apply to this, which will allow the change to survive review.
Is it your opinion that any changes that are retroactive would be, any changes we make retroactively would be upheld in the
court? Clearly, any changes for new hires, there's no legal issue. So, I mean, consistent with the unilateral contract issue. Question is, can you change those factors for people who are currently in the system? And I would have to say that a straightforward application of unilateral contract theories adopted by our courts would say no. And so again, I think if you're going to go through the process and adopt some changes, then you're going to have to think why, how's DOJ going to explain to the court why that's a good idea, and in fact consistent with an adequate protection of members' interests and members' rights. And I don't think there's any magic formula to that. I mean, I think it's just is a matter of thinking this through and trying to come up with something that you think is ultimately defensible. My client reminds me that perhaps what you meant and that I didn't understand was that you were asking about the governor's suggestion that they could do this retroactively to 03. I think that, well, let me back up and answer that this way. I don't think the starting date is key. I think what's key here is what level of protection will you give to people who are already in the system. I do think there are other problems with trying to be retroactive. So in other words, if you ask me, could we start new tables on January 29th, I'd say, sure, if you have adequate protections. But I do think that trying to go backwards to try to say we would like to do it retroactively, for instance, to January 1st, raises issues having to do with people retiring and the locking in of their retirement rights. So if you were asking me to comment on the governor's thoughts, those would be my thoughts on the governor's thoughts.
Thank you. Any other thoughts that I want answered to? Anybody else?
Let me know, and I will try to
Thank
think
you.
On their thoughts as well.
Is it your opinion that any part of the Lipscomb decision can be appealed to the Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court? Are there any issues there that are appealable to that?
On behalf of the interveners that I represented in that litigation, we've already appealed. But that currently is appealed to the Court of Appeals because, of course, that's the next court you go to. All of the issues are appealable to the Court of Appeals. If the legislature decides to do as you've done in other circumstances and permit a direct appeal to the Supreme Court, because I know that's one of the bills you'll be considering, then all of those issues would go to the Oregon Supreme Court.
Right.
I don't think there are any issues that I can think of in the Lipscomb case which would be appropriate for appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you. It. And I will be happy to return if you Need some more thoughts?
I'm sure we'll need your presence again.
Thank you.
Thank you. There are other people on. There are other people on the list for 2004. Jack, did you want to testify mainly on 2004 or 5?
Four. I think they're both of them in about 5 minutes.
Well, that'd be terrific. That'd save us some issues. Beyond that, is there anybody else who wanted to testify today that isn't here on a normal basis? Seeing nobody else, Jack will end our testimony on both these bills. I'll open a dual public hearing on House Bill 2005.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jack Salas. I reside at 2410 Fisher Road Northeast in Salem, and I'm the Secretary Treasurer of Oregon PERS Retirees, Inc., which is an organization we formed 11 years ago, and we were the group that sued you for taxing our pensions.
You're welcome.
I'm a little confused by Sections 3 and 4 of 2004. Section 3 says the PERS Board shall first adopt actuarial equipment tables under Section 2 of this Act to become effective January 1, 2004. Then you get down to Section 4, and it says the Board shall use tables adopted under this section to compute payments to be made to any member who has an effective date of retirement that is blank days or more after the effective date of this 2003 Act and before January 1, 2004. They don't seem to mesh.
Okay.
And the purpose of the delay to 2004 was allow the people, once they know the mortality table is going to be adopted at a specific date, is to give them a chance to bail out. Because their pensions will be cut about 8 to 12% according to PERS if they don't retire before the effective date of the mortality table. And I don't really see the importance of putting so many days in there after the effective date of the Act, because it's already said that they're supposed to adopt tables first effective January 1st, 2004.
We'll have amendments.
Okay. I just wanted to bring that up. On 2005, I was going to come down and suggest what you've already got amendments to do, so I think that's a good idea to split it up that way. You've got three non-PERS people that are the majority of the board, and you've got some other representatives on there that can provide interest. All I can say is those five people are going to have a hell of a job, because I've been working with PERS statutes for 14 years, and you still can't find what you're looking for if you look all over, and it's going to be a long learning curve. So I just wish them luck.
Thank you. With that, we'll go ahead and close the hearings on 2004-2005. And is there anything else for the good of the order today? It would be my intent to likely go to work session on 2005 on Thursday. CARA amendments were distributed?
On 2005, yes.
2005? Dash threes. Were those yours, Greg?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Greg had dash threes done. Everybody take a look at those and get back to us with your thoughts on either before committee or on Thursday. Thank you. If nothing else, committee's adjourned.
No, thank you.